Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Itamar Theodore about a brand new, fascinating contribution to the field of Hindu studies called The Bhagavad Gita, A Critical Introduction. Welcome back to the program, Itamar.
Very happy to be here.
Yes, indeed. Given that we're all on Zoom in different time zones, I've realized that the ancient Indians came up with namaste for Zoom. Because, you know, you can't say good morning, you can't say good afternoon, you can't say good evening. We'll just say namaste, because then it's across the board. The wisdom of the rishis. Anyhow, tell us how this came about. How did this book came about? And also maybe in tandem, you can answer organically, the Bhagavad Gita, a critical introduction. I mean, certainly there's no shortage of books written on the Bhagavad Gita. Certainly there's no shortage of books, introductory material on the Gita. So in tandem, tell us how this project came about and really what is the niche that you're hoping to fill with this volume?
As opposed to my other books, which were my own initiative, in this case, the initiative came from a publisher, Routledge. They saw the need for a critical introductory volume on the Bhagavad Gita. So much was published on the Bhagavad Gita. Some say it was overpublished. Still, they thought that there should be an introductory volume covering various aspects. And actually, they approached me and asked me whether I would be willing to do such a volume. So that's the truth. Once they made that offer, I was very happy about it, because I really thought there's a scope for such a book, bringing together more or less these various aspects as the book includes, really. Of course, I also think that there's room for other books in the future. But that's another thing. This is a critical introduction, as it names denotes. It's an introductory book. It aspires to encompass the main topics, the main non-topics of the Gita. Of course, there could have been more, but that's the main categories, the main topics for which the Gita is known: philosophy, gurus, national involvement, and so forth. We will probably discuss that more in deeper detail later.
Yeah, we definitely will. Maybe another sort of what I call 30,000 foot view question might be, you know, who would be interested in this book? I mean, I personally, for example, teach folks intro epics, ethics, even the Bhagavad Gita. And for me, for example, this would be a great teaching tool, I think, to assign some of these chapters. But I'm wondering, without putting words in your mouth, like, who do you think would most benefit or resonate with this volume?
Well, first of all, teachers, professors, university courses. That book supplies the main topics of the on the Gita. But then also general readership, people who are interested in the Gita. There are much Gita editions coming. And also in the book, it's apparent that the Gita is published time and again, and commented upon time and again. Actually, since Shankara's time, it's been commented, and various editions came out. And surprisingly, each one is slightly different from the other, as is apparent from Arvind Sharma's chapter. There's no one interpretation, so many interpretations. The Gita is very flexible. You have some more mystical interpretations, some more political, some more philosophical, argumentative. I mean, Advaita against Vishishta Advaita and Advaita, philosophical controversies. You have commentaries into by Muslim thinkers, medieval Muslim thinkers, who translate and comment upon the Gita in Persian. You have vernaculars, Marathi, Odissi, I mean, everything, so many versions. And surprisingly, each one is different than the other. I mean, you can't find one correct, one absolute interpretation. Just so many interpretations and directions and topics to be emphasized. So the Gita is an object of of reading. It's an attractive object of reading, and so far it's continuing. I don't see it stopping. I just see its popularity growing.
Well, it's one of these masterpieces of world literature that are inexhaustible in their ability to comment on the human experience, in their ability to teach us. And whether we're looking to be taught about culture or about spirituality or about India, in the grand sense, Hinduism, say, it's a rich work. And I think the enterprise or the project of the Gita is to fold together these various strands. And because it's so textured, it can readily be, various readers or thinkers will focus on the piece that most resonates. You know, Ramanuja will say one thing about the Gita, Shankara will say one thing. And these are people in a very relatively specific worldview, culture, enterprise, as maybe theologians we can call them. It's a rich text, and there's a number of ways in which folks can read it. And when you're providing a critical introduction, certainly there are certain methodologies or certain aspects that you are aiming to set up. So I don't know if we want to do this systematically or not, but maybe you could talk a little bit about the contributions or what comes to mind in terms of some of the different kinds of methods or contributions in the volume.
Well, I would say that some chapters would be more historical. I would say, like, for example, Arvind Sharma's methodology would be historical. He would survey tens and tens of commentaries and translations and editions, compare them, categorize them. He would categorize them in terms of chronology, but also in terms of philosophy and ideology. So that would be more, I would say, that would be more historical. But then we have chapters which are more theological. I would say that my own work is more theological, in that I try to look at the structure of the Bhagavad Gita. It's actually doing theology, doing the theology of the Gita, dividing the various layers, the various tiers, the ladder of values. And that would also be true perhaps for Joseph O'Connell's chapter, where he looks into Gaudiya Vaishnavism and its ambivalent relations to the Gita. On the one hand, wanting to adopt the Gita because that's Krishna's words, and Gaudiya Vaishnavism, they worship Krishna, and that would be an object of veneration. But then their ambivalent understanding of both karma and dharma, and specifically varnashrama dharma. Is it good or is it bad? Is it material? Is it external? Does it distract one from devotion, from bhakti to Krishna? Or is it useful for that? It's actually an argument within the tradition. They're not sure. And as such, only about a century and a half after the demise of Sri Chaitanya, you'll get the first Gita commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti, who's in a sense one of the focuses of this book, perhaps the connecting axis. So yeah, that would be more theological. Then you have chapters which are more, I would say, cultural. For example, Richard Davis's chapter about the Mahatmyas, Gita Mahatmyas, where the treatment of the Gita is not as a philosophy or as a text, but as a religious object in itself. The Gita itself, the reading of the Gita, the writing of the Gita, that in itself is a religious ritual. And your own chapter is also that category. You look into the cultural aspects, how within the text, different epithets, different names are applied to both Krishna and Arjuna. And you divide them into groups, patronymes, and in other groups, and consider that Achyuta would be the main, perhaps the purest, the most influential, or the most essential epithet. So I would say that is more of a cultural methodology, or return to the historical one, perhaps looking at G. Lulin's chapter about the gurus. That would be more, sociological, dividing the various gurus, looking at the various gurus, what did you try to promote, which kind of values and ideas and doctrines. And also Jim Ryan's chapter about the national leaders is similar in dividing and looking into the national leaders, specifically Tilak, Sri Aurobindo, and Gandhi, and what they did with the Gita, actually quite opposing. I mean, Tilak and Aurobindo is one thing, and Gandhi is something completely different, promoting nonviolence, ahimsa. So so the various methodologies, it's not only a one-sided, it's not only comparative theology, it's not only philosophy, it's not only history, not only sociology, not only cultural studies, but we try to get the various aspects, and as the name goes, it is a introductory, critical introduction. We look at the Gita from a critical point of view, we ask questions, we want to categorize it to different categories, and try to gain a wide point of view. Yeah.
Well, it's you've preempted my next question in the answer to this one, which is perfect. But the variety of methods that are evidenced, that are featured in this volume, bespeak the variety of aspects of Hindu culture or the Indian civilization that the Gita touches, whether it's sociology, whether it's politics, whether it's theology, you know, whether it's some sort of mystical seeking life. It's used in these various different ways and hits these various different layers of the human experience. And so, of course, a critical introduction, rightfully, in my opinion, approaches the text from these various different dimensions. I was actually very, very happy to be able to contribute to this myself, because sort of... No, I really was. I was honored, and I was happy because I had this sort of this piece of narrative studies, right? What does the world of the text say? This literary analysis of the text. And yet, isn't it interesting that the literary analysis corroborates things that we see elsewhere in philosophy or theology of the text? I just find it interesting that folks can arrive at the central themes of the Gita from very different methodologies.
I'm agreeing, very happy about it. Yeah, I mean, you touch in your own chapter. You touch actually aesthetics. It could have been developed. I mean, that corresponds with rasa, aesthetics, emotional aspects too. And I think it's very important. It's a very important contribution to the book, no doubt.
Well, I muse because part of how I read Sanskrit narrative is through frames, either formally through ring composition or certainly through framing devices, the opening frame that necessarily has a closing corollary at the end of the text, right? So I'm fascinated with the structure of the text and what the structure has to say about the text. So when I look at the table of contents of these 10 contributions, it starts off with you talking about structure and then it ends up with me talking about structure.
It's wonderful. I'm really happy about it.
What do you, maybe we'll say a little bit about some of the data, like what do you share in your article about the structure of the Bhagavad Gita and the ladders you alluded to before?
Well, basically, I envision the structure of the Bhagavad Gita. I call it a three-story house model. I do two things there. One thing is divide the Bhagavad Gita into layers. There's a famous cave, Plato's cave, which has a similar idea of different, in ancient philosophy, Greek philosophy, of different layers of existence. Accordingly, some live in a cave and they have the experience of the cave, and then someone goes out and experiences real life. And I think the Gita, or in general, Indian philosophy has this concept of a hierarchical reality. Not all systems, but some systems have this idea that reality is divided into layers. It's not one reality, but there are different layers and different people live in different worlds, in parallel worlds, so to speak. So the first element of my structure is that three stories and trying to show that we have one by another. We have this humanistic layer, basically the Vedic layer, which has a whole set of values about humans living in this world and aspiring to prosper in this world. The whole Vedic life with going to heaven, Svarga and Naraka and everything, and sacrifices. But then we have the whole yogic layer, which is completely different. The whole concept is different. The ontology is different. Ethics are different. The human being is no longer a complete term. It's broken. You have the soul. Never mind if it's Atman or Jiva or Purusha. Let's leave it aside. But you have the self, and the self is different from the body and the mind and the senses. It's all deconstructed into various elements, and the gunas work there. And you have samsara, the self, transmigrating through samsara. It's a completely different world of values, of ideas, of ontology, of ethics. The ethics is not anymore, no longer aspiring to prosper in this world. Rather, the ethics becomes something different, to be indifferent to samatva, to be indifferent, to be equal in happiness and distress, loss or gain, victory and defeat, and so forth. So it's something different, and the ontology is different. So I try to show that. And then you have the level of moksha, which can be either in the Advaita line, which is there in the book, or in the Vishishta Advaita, the personal version of moksha, of bhakti, love in the spiritual world. That's, again, it's different conversation. So I try to highlight these three layers which exist one by the other. And also there's flexibility. A person can be here and then move back there. There's a flexibility in that. And then I try to show the ladder of action, which, as I quote already in the preface, the source of which is Vishwanath Chakravarti. He has it in his Gita commentary, 18th century Gita commentary. He has these ideas and these are developed, and he's also mentioned by Joseph O'Connell, and also Arvind Sharma mentioned the ladder idea in his own chapter, and I developed that. And according to that ladder, one can purify, one can raise one's consciousness, one's position, one's existential position through this ladder of action. And this ladder of action looks into one's internal position. into one's position of motives. What motivates one? Is it utilitarianism? Is it duty for its own sake? Is it yoga? Is it bhakti? So that is actually the internal state the ladder looks into. And interestingly enough, despite these various internal positions, the Gita is always dharmic. It always adheres to dharma. Whether one is in a lower utilitarian state, one should do one's dharma. And whether one is elevated to a higher state, one still has to adhere to dharma. It is also there in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says to Arjuna, look at myself, means Krishna looks at himself, says, I'm beyond dharma. I'm liberated. I don't need to follow a dharma. I don't need to purify myself in any way. But he says, I do follow dharma. I do adhere to dharma in order to give example for a Lokasangra, which is that term, which is the center for a Bal Gangadhar Tilak, Lokasangra. So Krishna emphasizes that in the third chapter. He says, I do it in order to give an example. So really that structure, to my mind, can turn the Gita into a universal philosophy. I mean, that's my inspiration. I actually think that the Gita has this potential. And I'm aware that my interpretation is one among many others. I'm, of course, aware of that. But my own interpretation is that the Gita is a work, potentially a universal philosophy. Actually, I have it in another article I published that the Gita is a potential philosophy for the 21st century for various reasons, because of its flexibility, multiculturalism, mystical dimensions, because it adheres to Dharma. Dharma actually is adhered to all over the Gita. There's no place where Krishna tells Arjuna, you should renounce, leave Dharma, don't do your duty. It's always doing the duty, performing one's duty, but from various mental or internal states, which change from person to person, and even from moment to moment. A person can be on the mystical level and then go back and something may catch his or her attention and they may be quite within the body, something happens, and then they go back into meditations. So that flexibility, I'm trying to show that in the structure, how that structure can encompass various states of consciousness and states of beings, and also the way encourage everyone to adhere to Dharma within different states in a very universal way, in a very flexible way, in a very encompassing way, which I think is the greatness of the Gita. And even the gunas, even that part of that, because if one is in the lowest guna, in tamaguna, then one can go higher to a rajas. Rajas is better. And if one is in rajas, one can go to a sattva, to that goodness state. So even that goes even, that makes the structure even wider.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, let's just revisit this idea that you're putting forth just for 1 second. I have a follow-up question, but first, Just for those listening to follow along, very succinctly, the three tiers are what you
the
call
the lowest
them?
One is the humanistic one. The second tier is the yogic one, the world of yoga, and the highest one is moksha.
So,
and I see the Gita interplay.
So, moksha.
The lowest level is the humanistic level. If you go from bottom upwards, it would be the humanistic one, man in the world, human being in the world.
The mundane
then
world,
that would
yes.
be the world of yoga. World of yoga would be like an intermediate floor, trying to detach oneself from the world and attach oneself to the highest state of moksha. And eventually up there is moksha in various forms of moksha. But
you use moksha the same way it's classically used in terms of the result of liberation, right? Or atmajnana, right?
Yeah, liberation, although as I also point out in the book and also in my own chapter and also in the book, there are various interpretations of that state of moksha. And specifically, Shankara would get the Advaita Vedanta type of moksha, merging, losing one's individuality, and Ramanuja and Madhva, and that line, and of course, Achintya Veda, would get it differently, a personal liberation, keeping one's personality, personhood, in the state of moksha. That is an internal argument within the tradition. But I acknowledge both types. Moksha in its Advaita, in its impersonal version, moksha in its personal version. I acknowledge that there are various ideas of moksha. But the main thing is moksha is the goal of the Gita, getting up there to moksha, getting from the humanistic level, climbing up the ladder step by step in various ways. The ladder is not unified. There can be various ways to go about it. One can emphasize more yoga. One can emphasize more bhakti, various ways. One can emphasize more jnana, knowledge, philosophy, cognition. But the goal is the same. It's going always up. That is the goal. The goal is going up and up, raising one's consciousness, elevating one thoughts in this march from human life to moksha. The goal, to my mind, is one. Although it has various ways and various people can do it in different ways, but the goal is there. I think this is very much in line with other thinkers. I mean, all through the book, like you see Sri Aurobindo, he speaks of integral yoga in terms of karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga. So he would say that bhakti yoga would cater more to the emotional aspects of one's being, and jnana yoga for that philosophical, and karma yoga would make one progress through action. So these are the ideas are actually traditional. It's not something new or innovative, but I do put it together, these traditional ideas. I think I'm not saying anything new, but I am putting them in a frame. I'm trying to bring them all together. I know that my structure is somewhat scholastic. I know it's a little rational, and one may ask, did the ancient seers think about three stories? I'm not sure, but I think it's a way to conceptualize the Gita in this day and age, in our language.
Is not the enterprise here an academic one? Is not our dharma, so to speak, to be scholastic? This is why it's a critical introduction to the Gita versus a dharma talk, right? versus satsang, right?
Yeah. Actually, I like the subtlety of what you're saying, that actually we're doing a dharma. We're academics.
Ah, you got it.
Exactly. We are just doing a dharma. Yeah.
Oh, the dharma of the scholar.
Exactly. The dharma of a scholar is to be critical and scholastic. Exactly. That's what we're doing.
So, two questions. One, which should I say first? Okay. So, I'll do the second one first. Let's entertain this idea of universalization, the universalizability of what we hear or see in the Gita. On the one hand, of course, no culture has a monopoly on wisdom. And of course, wisdom is like water. Everyone needs it across the globe, clearly, right? And it quenches the thirst of all kinds of folks. But the question, on the one hand, certainly there's wisdom here for everyone. That's part of the power of the Gita. On the other hand, the Bhagavad Gita is situated in a very, in the history of world religions, in a very specific classical Hindu or classical Indian worldview, where the top tier of your house, the moksha, is something that, if I'm teaching world religions, for example, I may teach Abrahamic faiths in one fell swoop and talk about a common worldview, and then I may teach Indian faiths and talk about a very different overarching worldview where the problem is escaping suffering and opting out, getting to the top of the house. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether or not that is a tension to the universalizability of the Gita, or whether you think that there is an analog. I mean, how would these tiers apply to one, for example, who is a modern secular Western citizen?
Well, I would say that the Gita has also some non-religious and secular aspects. And I mean the natural aspects based on the Sankhya philosophy of the gunas and the yogis, the yogic parts. I mean, I think what happened, when the Gita came to the West, it was interpreted in Western terms. The West is monotheistic, I mean, non-secular, and therefore, Krishna's personality was emphasized as God. The Gita's monotheistic aspects were emphasized. However, the Gita also has these Sankhya trends, aspects, which are secular, basically. There's not necessarily any devotion there in the Sankhya. When you discuss the gunas, there's not really devotion there. It's an ontological categorization of the world, and it's a good secular philosophy, really. So I think that the Gita also has these aspects, and I published a few years ago a volume on a comparative Indian and Chinese philosophy. I was working in Hong Kong, and we had an AR panel on the Bhagavad Gita and Chinese thought. And I was presenting the Bhagavad Gita's natural components, the gunas. I consider the gunas to be close to yin and yang in many ways. And the Tao. I mean, I offered a Chinese reading of the Gita, and the respondent to that panel, that was Professor Lori Patton, and she said, "Wow, that's very interesting that you're highlighting all these aspects of the Gita which can be considered to be secular. I mean, there's no real focus on Ishvara, on Krishna, on bhakti, but the Gita can also be read in that way." And I said, yes, when the Gita came to the West, naturally the theistic aspects were emphasized because the West speaks in these terms, monotheistic God, devotion, praising God, and so forth, and specifically Christianity. But then the Gita has these other aspects. When you bring the Gita in the dialogue with Judaism, you'll find that Dharma would correspond to the law, to halakha. Halakha is similar to dharma, the Jewish concept of law. And actually, I did another book called Dharma and Halakha, emphasizing that comparative Hindu-Jewish studies and emphasizing these aspects. So the Gita is rich, and when you bring the Gita into dialogue with the Chinese, of course, secular thought, Confucian thought, you can see all these categories of duty, of dharma, of the gunas, of balance, which are non-Western. And I think they would be inspiring for a secular person also. I mean, Gita is rich. It can inspire someone who is inclined to philosophy, someone who is inclined to religion, to religious emotions, in worship and devotion. but also to those who look for a good humanistic secular philosophy. That's the way I see it. Yeah.
Well, this it's certainly multifaceted, and it has the power to captivate people on different levels. This perhaps it's a conversation for another day, but you know the question of theism being the question of the sort of the theistic reception of the Gita being a function of its transplanting it to the West. Then there's a question of like Madhvacharya or Ramanuja, or obviously there's a lot of texture in that we can unpack for another day. One thing that kind of strikes me, I think of Hinduism as the tension between two very different worldviews or ideologies, the household and renouncer, or sort of the Vedic ethos and the yogic ethos or the ascetic ethos, such that clearly it's, the Vedic ethos has won out in terms of the mundane world and how we relate to society and caste and dharma in a perspectival sense. And certainly the ascetic ethos has won out in terms of what we supremely value. This ethos of detachment, this lofty theology of transcendence or self-realization. And I, you know, I really think of it as this double helical structure. That's how I think of Hinduism, broadly speaking. And I think certain texts, I think the Mahabharata, for example, its job is to spin this walking contradiction of different religiosities. So when I hear your three-tiered house, really, I think of that first tier as this sort of Vedic platform, or sort of the individual in the world, and it's very practical, right? You know, a butcher has a dharma, right? A scholar has a dharma, right? We want the armed forces to be armed, right? They need violence is needed to protect the state, you know. The second tier for me is sort of the second strand of the double helix of dharma, where it's otherworldly, it's geared towards something interior, it's geared towards transcendence. It as you say, it ultimately leads to moksha, or the apex or the attic of this house, if you will. And maybe you can comment on that a little bit. I know I'm sort of, I don't mean to appropriate what you're saying for my thinking or to project the way I think of it onto what you're saying, but I sort of see an analog between what I call this double helix and what you call this multi-tiered house. Would you agree with that? And this is an open-ended question.
I very much agree with that. When you speak, I think in the same terms, that you have these layers live side by side. The Vedic layer is very clearly the humanistic layer. The self-understanding of the Vedic person is a complete, a whole human being. The body is not an object of a contempt. The human being is a whole term. It's not to be deconstructed. This deconstruction comes through the yoga worldview. But the Gita builds bridges between them. That's also very interesting. For example, the Gita considers the four varnas in terms of the gunas, which is very interesting, that the four varnas, Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, they are described in the 18th chapter in terms of the gunas. I mean, you take the gunas, which are part of Sankhya Yoga philosophy, basically second tier, and you apply them to the Vedic concept. The Gita makes this conception, this combination, which is very interesting. Very interesting, I would say, explanation of the varnas in terms of Sankhya Yoga philosophy, in terms of the gunas. The Brahmins are more sattvic, and the Kshatriyas are more rajasic, and so forth. So the Gita does make these combinations which allow it all to reside together in harmony. One can adhere to one's dharma also as a yogi. It's karma yoga in its best way. So I agree completely with you that the Vedic is the humanistic layer and the yogic layer is for detachment and for struggling with the mind and getting oneself yoked to spirituality, and all these live side by side in the Gita. So on the one hand, for methodological purposes, I separate them, because to discuss them, I have to look at them, separate them, saying this is one, this is two, this is three. But really, in real life, they converge, they mix together, they work together, they exist together, and a person moves between them, sometimes in a more yogic, sometimes a more humanistic way. And that's, I think, the greatest of the Gita. But again, methodologically speaking, I would have to separate them to be able to discuss their qualities, the merits, and so forth, separately. But that is a methodological step. But really, they're quite mingled, they're quite mixed, they're quite they live in harmony with each other. But yes, I see your point and I like it. I agree with you.
Sure, sure. I'll say it just so happens that in this case, I'm a contributor to the work. So I'll say a quick sentence or two about the article, the chapter that I contributed, which is the final one. It's chapter 10, Arjuna and Achyuta, the import of epithets in the Bhagavad Gita. And it's sort of really drawing on my penchant towards looking at the structure of a narrative for clues on how to read the narrative, the assumption being that the architects of the text, the authors, those who are... whether it was inspired or by humans or that which is beyond the humans, nevertheless, human hands penned it, so to speak. And so in human ingenuity, crafted it. This is smriti, it was remembered. And so the first and the last, the alpha and the omega, you know, in our volume, you're the first contribution, I'm the last contribution. We're both talking about structure. But if you look at the epithets in the Bhagavad Gita, right, the ways in which you know, God is named or Krishna is addressed, you know, you could have an individual and you can call that individual Professor so and so or Mom, or they're a citizen according to the government, or a subject, or the various aspects of an individual based on, you know, the situations. And so, you know, in fine Hindu form, Krishna has a number of epithets by which he's called through the Bhagavad Gita, and it is my sort of observation and or assertion that the epithets are not merely because of a certain prosodic need, a certain metric need, like we need two syllables, one guru, one laghu, one heavy, one light, because that'll satisfy the needs of Anushtup Chanda. I mean, there's a number of epithets that could satisfy the needs of the verse, but what I'm saying is, look, no, they pick certain epithets for certain reasons at certain points in the text. And what I say is, if you look at the very first epithet, it's Achyuta. Of all the times that Krishna is addressed in the Bhagavad Gita, he's called Achyuta in the very first time. And guess what? If you look at the very last time he's addressed, where Arjuna says, "You've dispelled my doubts. I'm done. I'm fully baked. I've been transformed. I'm convinced. I'll sign. Where do I sign? Let's move on." He calls him Achyuta, the unfallen one. And more than that, not just the beginning, the alpha and the omega, and it's sort of what I notice in texts like the Devi Mahatmya, is that there's a ring composition where there's a beginning, there's an end, and there's a thing in the middle you're supposed to be paying attention to. So for example, the middle episode of the Devi Mahatmya is the Mahishasura Mardhini episode. It's the most iconographically celebrated episode, you know, in Hindudom, right? And so there's one more time where they pay attention, where they use the word Achyuta. And the one time they use it is right after the Vishvarupa. There couldn't be a greater apex to the aspects of the divine than the Vishvarupa. And he's like, "Look, Achyuta, I can't, you know, just give me my mundane eyes back. I'm sorry I asked for this wish. Like, just, you know, that was a great trip. We need to get sober now. I can't deal with this anymore." So Achyuta at the beginning, Achyuta at the end, Achyuta when he's showing his divine cosmic form. So that's sort of, I think, very important to the text. I think the fact that that's conscious or structured, I think, to my mind, is self-evident. And then the interpretive piece comes in, well, you know, okay, fine, I buy what you're saying. It means something, fine. What does it mean? Why? Why that epithet why is it saying that that is the epithet that is cradling all the epithets? Why is that the frame of all the epithets? Why? Because what's Krishna's job? Krishna's like, Utishta, Utishta, get the hell up. His whole goal is to render Arjuna upstanding, morally upstanding, physically upstanding, spiritually upstanding, emotionally upstanding. And why can he do that? Because Krishna is Achyuta. He's unfallen. He's unfallible. He's permanently upstanding. And so whether you buy my interpretation or not, I think you can nevertheless see that one hopes that you can see that the placement of that epithet is obviously conscious in the text. And that's sort of what I talk about in my article.
Thank you very much for that.
Oh, no, no. Thank you. Thank you for providing a home for that. I had that idea churned out during my dissertating days, and I shelved it because I just had to follow the logic of my methodology for the PhD for this, the Bhagavad Gita. I shelved it. I'm like, I'm not going to write a book on the Gita. What am I going to do with this? I shelved it. And then I think...
All that, we also have all kinds of materials we write, and then we hopefully publish them here and there. That's life.
And a nice shelf came along to showcase it.
It's great for us.
Yeah, what's... Oh, there's so much we could do, but, you know, we'll wrap up shortly. I know you're tight for time as well. But what... Thinking of the volume overall, okay, we've talked about some of the content, some of the methodologies, sort of the contribution to scholarship. Was there anything that really you found quite surprising or illuminating or stood out to you as the editor of this? What was impressed upon you putting this together?
Well, first of all, it was easy. People know the materials, and it wasn't too difficult to find the authors for very interesting topics. So that was very encouraging. And maybe the most surprising article was Joseph O'Connell's article, which I found actually, he passed away, of course, and also the book is dedicated to him and to Professor Narasimhachari. Professor O'Connell, he was both were my professors at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies some 20 years ago. I learned with both. With Professor O'Connell and with Professor Narasimhachari. So the book is dedicated to both of them. And I think Professor O'Connell's chapter is unique in that he highlights a point which is not really known. I don't think that point of the, the debate between the debate within the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition as to the Gita. In the introduction, I quote Bankim Chatterjee's Anandamat, translated by Judith Lipner, and I highlight the same point, which is a question whether devotees, people of devotion, are actually committed to Dharma and actually warfare, and in a wider sense, a karma working in the world. And that also comes in Nandamad by Bankim Chandra Chatterjee, and as I mentioned, I quote him so in the preface. So I think that chapter by Joseph O'Connell is specifically interesting because that point is not so much known. Other points that Ramanuja and Shankara diverge, we know that this is something known, or that Gandhi and Tilak diverge in their positions, we know that. But this point which Joseph O'Connell brought, Professor O'Connell, about this ambiguity, this ambivalency within the tradition in its relation to karma and dharma, that was for me a surprise. I was very happy to find that and to publish that in this year.
Fantastic. And just so our listeners can understand, did he contribute that to the volume towards the end of his life, or is it something he discovered thereafter?
I discovered that he published that in the Journal of Vaishnava Studies some 20 years ago. And I found that. And of course, I asked permission
Stephen Rosen.
From spouse. Yeah, of course. And she was very happy about me publishing that, and of course, from Journal of Vaishnava Studies. But yeah, he published that around the year 2000, some 20 years ago. And that was, we adopted that and republished that, yeah, that paper.
Fascinating. And wonderful. The other thing I'll make mention of is I may have once knew, but didn't realize you also had a connection or history with the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. I'm not sure if you know, but I've just started
I was
teaching
the
there.
You're a teacher there, you're a fellow there. And I was in the first group of students. We started in 1999. It was
wow.
Yeah. We were the first students. It was Kenneth Valpey, Ravi Gupta, Manjari Talent, and myself in 1999, the first group of students. And yes, I studied there for the next 4 years or so, till 2003 or so.
That's fascinating. So 20 years later, this podcast, I tell you, I ended up discovering their online platform. Of course, I was floored because I thought, wow, if I was still doing my training, I mean, if I was an undergrad or a continuing studies sort of learner, this would be like a treasure trove. So I sent some random message to the OCHS to say, no, do you want to plug on the podcast? Like, can we help you to, you know, I imagine the people who listen to the podcast are the people that you're serving. And he's like, sure. And I had Nick Sutton come on the podcast to talk about the continuing studies program and his publication of the Yoga Sutras and Bhagavad Gita. He also had a new translation of the Bhagavad Gita. I said, that was cool. And it was from that every month, there was a different layer of involvement. And then, would you like to tutor for us? Sure, why not? So I'm tutoring some courses for them. Would you like to be on our course development board? Sure, why not? Would you like to speak at our weekend school? Sure, why not? I'm just currently organizing their next weekend school, which is going to be on yoga. It should be fun. So clearly they decided to keep me. Who knows in what capacity, but it's a really, really rich space because it does good critical work that's not reductionistic, and it attracts people who also have a personal relationship to Hinduism or maybe seeking on a personal path, and nevertheless they can get good solid content. So it's interesting that we have that piece in common as well. Before we go, before we go too far,
there's another Canadian connection there besides a Professor O'Connell. There was Professor Klaus Klostermeyer, who was also the academic director when I came there. So he's also Canadian, and he also supervised me for a while. So actually more than a while. So yes, it's all there in the OCHS. Yeah.
Fantastic. Mysterious are the ways of karma indeed. So before we go too far down the rabbit hole of institutional nostalgia, I want to thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today. Was there anything else you wanted to share before we sign off?
No, everything's fine. I thank you very much. It was a great interview, and I hope that the book will actually be very useful, that people will read it and study from it. And hopefully we'll even one day do more books because the Gita is so rich. So more can be
seen. Well, when you come back with the next one, I know of a place where you can have a podcast. Great. So thank you very much. For those of you out there listening, if you're interested in the Bhagavad Gita, if you're studying it for your personal growth, in particular, if you're studying it through an academic paradigm, if you're teaching it, this may well be an excellent resource for you. It is published by Routledge this very year, 2020. It's called quite aptly The Bhagavad Gita, A Critical Introduction, edited by my guest today, Dr. Itamar Theodore. Until next time, keep reading, keep listening, stay safe, and keep contemplating the epithets of Krishna.